SeaRealm Vault Podcast, episode number 426. Monday, May 16th, 2022.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, so it's now Monday morning. It's actually 6:36 a.m. and until a couple days ago, I would have been asleep at this time. But on Saturday morning, I interviewed a bodybuilder turned bodybuilding entrepreneur, event organizer named Shiru Angrish. And we didn't talk about bodybuilding much. We mostly talked about meditation and other health practices. He is a lifelong meditator. He gets up every day at 4 a.m. and meditates for at least an hour and somewhere between an hour and 90 minutes. And I thought about that. I thought, wow, what if, I mean, I meditate, but I use an app and typically I meditate for 10 minutes a day. It is really just scratching the surface, you know, but it is that very first effort that yields an outsized benefit compared to, you know, the diminishing returns you get by putting more time and effort into the practice. Or so I tell myself. So thinking about that, I thought, you know, I do my best work in the morning. The best attention that I have, the best energy, the best focus that I can bring to whatever work I'm going to do, be it podcasting, writing, drawing, it comes in the morning. And I talk to Rose for usually an hour every morning. So, you know, that's a slice out of my best work time. And then, you know, the second that I tune into the various news and analysis shows that I consume, either watch or listen to, my best focus thereafter has been disrupted and I'm caught up in thoughts. Not that I'm, you know, thoughtless or free from intrusive thoughts in the mornings, but still, the mornings are my best focus, my best time for doing the sort of work that I do. So I thought, what if I got up every morning at 4 a.m., meditated, you know, made coffee, brushed my teeth, all that stuff, and was at work, like doing work at 5 a.m. You know, by 9, I would have put in a solid 4 hours already. So Sunday morning, set my alarm for 4. I actually woke up at 4 just before the alarm went off, canceled the alarm, got up, went and brushed my teeth, and splashed some cold water on my face, came back to my room, sat down. And usually I do a 10-minute meditation using the Headspace app. For this one, I just use the Amazon Echo and I use a meditation timer. You just ask, you know, for a set amount of time. And I did 20 minutes instead of 10. There's no guidance. It just plays some like ambient background sounds. And then there's a little chime at the end of your selected time. So I did that. And by the time I was done with that, it was like a 4:45. And I started working, but I didn't make coffee. And I usually make coffee. I mean, the coffee's usually brewing while I'm meditating. Usually the last gurgles of the coffee maker cycle coincide with the final moments of my meditation. And basically by about the time the sun was coming up, you know, the sky was just turning red along the horizon. I got really sleepy and I went back to sleep and I slept until after 8 a.m. So this morning, again, I set the alarm for 4, but at 4, I made the decision, you know what? 5 a.m. seems a lot more reasonable. To me, 4 a.m. is still the night. But one of the reasons why Shiru Angrish meditates, gets up at 4 and meditates, is that in the tradition of the spiritual practitioner that he follows, a very famous practitioner, by the way, named Sadhguru, 4 a.m. is a particularly auspicious time, a particularly effective time. But as long as you do it any time before the sun comes up, you're getting better benefit from your meditation than you will after the sun comes up. So I thought, well, you know, if I get up at 5 instead of 4, to me, that's the morning. 5 o'clock in the morning is the morning, even if the sun hasn't come up. If I get up and get out of bed at that time, it seems more likely that I can, you know, really just start my day at that time. And unlike yesterday, I did make coffee this morning, and it brewed while I meditated. I switched over from Headspace to the Sam Harris Waking Up meditation app, which somebody got for me for Christmas last year, and which I haven't used that much, just because I'm just more comfortable and familiar with the routine and the voice and just the general structure of the meditations from the Headspace app. But, you know, to mix it up and to get a little more length, I listened to two, I guess there's lectures, mini lectures by Sam Harris about meditation. And then I did one of his guided meditation sessions. Probably spent 25 minutes or so, you know, on the cushion. Got up, poured a cup of coffee. So I've had a cup and a half of coffee now, and I believe that I am up for the duration. But still, it's not yet 7 o'clock, and I'm already sitting here not only working, not only like, you know, reading and preparing to do a podcast, but actually speaking into the microphone. Now, you haven't heard this interview with Shiru Engrish yet because I did it for the Padverb podcast, and really it is Slava Borisov. I think you've heard him here on The Vault before. I appeared on his podcast for sure, and he and his business partner, Anna Haskell, were the guests on the, not the most recent C-Realm podcast, but the one just prior to that, episode 579. And he's being very professional about it. And that's, you know, something that I really like about this whole arrangement is that all I do is interview people. I don't edit the audio. I also record intros and outros like I do for the C-Realm podcast and for this podcast. But I don't edit the audio. I don't write the descriptions. I don't do the cover art. I just interview people, which is great. So Slava and other people that he contracts with, you know, they're building the website and they're handling everything else. And most importantly, they're handling the, booking of the guests, which is the producer's role. And that is a place where I did it for years and then I slacked off. And I tell myself that, you know, when I started the podcast, there weren't very many podcasts, and somebody who wasn't, you know, a known journalist or something could get pretty high profile guests. Well, now everybody has a podcast and the competition for guests is fiercer. I tell myself that, but I know that if I were to send out, you know, 3 emails, at least one of them would come back and I could book somebody. I just stopped doing that. So it's nice that Slava and the other people that he has contracted to work on this new podcast project are very professional. But one of the professional things that he's doing, which I certainly would not have the patience or discipline to do, is to build up a backlog of 5 interviews before releasing the first one. And we've only done 2 so far, you know, whereas for me, if I've recorded 2 interviews, I've released 2 interviews. That's just how I roll. Once it's done, I want feedback. I want to get it out there and I want to get a response, which is, for some reason, the way I've got the C-Realm podcast set up, and I guess the way people are consuming media these days, my podcasting efforts almost never generate any direct feedback. It's very rare that I get, you know, any sort of substantial feedback based on a podcast unless I post it to YouTube, which I've started doing with all new C-Realm podcasts. I'm not doing that with The Vault, obviously, because, you know, you got to pay to listen to The Vault. Although I realize not all of you are. Anyway, another advantage of getting up and recording at this time of day is it's mid-May. Can you believe it? May's half gone. And here I am in Arkansas. It's already getting hot. And I have a small room that I work in, and it's got a window air conditioning unit, but I can't record with that air conditioning going. So recording here before 7 a.m., you know, pretty nice in terms of the temperature. All right, so first up is the conclusion of the conversation with Lex Pelger that started in C-Realm podcast episode number 580. So if you haven't heard that yet, I would suggest you stop this podcast and go listen to that. I know the C-Realm and the C-Realm Vault are not on the same feed, and if you're not expecting a new C-Realm podcast episode, depending on, you know, your technological, algorithmically curated life, you might not be aware that I've put out a new C-Realm podcast. And a strange thing is, I've kind of let the C-Realm podcast go to the point where the link between the podcast hosting service that I use, which is Blueberry, and my WordPress website backend has been broken, and I'm not even getting any stats on downloads and listens. So I don't even know how many people are listening to the main Sea Realm podcast, or this podcast for that matter. But since this podcast is it's a paywalled podcast, I'm guessing that the subscriber base is, it must be, you know, at or somewhat lower than the number of people who are paying for the podcast. So I have a general idea of how many people listen to this podcast. I know that more people listen to the Free Sea Realm podcast, but I don't know how many more, which is a hilarious turn of events from when I first started podcasting. When I was still on Podomatic, I was checking multiple times a day for download stats. And now it's been, I don't know, a couple of years really since I've had access to the download stats for the Sea Realm podcast. And, you know, it would be a matter of 10 or 15 minutes really of figuring out how to reestablish the connection between the two services. But I think I'm about to change from Blueberry anyway to something else. So I haven't made that effort. All right. So first, I thought there was like 40 minutes left with Lex Pelger, but as I was listening to it yesterday, we came to a point where after about 17 minutes, of edited audio, I heard myself saying to Lex, well, you know, we're going to wrap it up here. Thanks so much. And I could see from the recording that there's like another 20 minutes of the recording, but it was off the record since I had said to Lex, okay, we're not in the podcast interview anymore. We're just talking. There's good stuff there. And I bet if I, you know, wrote to him and asked if I could share it, he would say yes, but I just cut it off there. So I have a lot of time to fill. So, well, I'll explain after the conclusion of the conversation with Lex how the structure of the rest of the hour will go. But for now, here's me concluding the conversation that began on Sea Realm podcast number 580, Always a Reader, with Lex Pelger.
I think for all of this kind of stuff, as much reading and research into the patterns of everything, the natural world, is going to be the most informative. As the early Christians said, the half the knowledge is in their holy book, the Bible, and the other half of knowledge is in the natural world itself. And that's a place that you can really learn a lot from.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, I had asked you to comment on what it's like to look back at the U.S. from outside of it. And you talked about France, but we never did get to that part of the question. So let me ask you to comment on that. Like, you're in France, I imagine. Do you have the same window under the world that I do? It's the internet. But the internet is different in different places. And depending on who you are, the algorithms will curate the world differently, you know, depending on how you've responded to their offerings in the past. So what do you see looking at the U.S. from afar, from France?
I think from here, I mean, the one thing to stress is how much the French people, you know, they are aghast at the leadership of the U.S., but they like the spirit of the people from the U.S., which is a nice thing. But they, of course, were horrified by Trump. But then on the flip side, they just almost voted in Le Pen, who is, you know, very avowedly racist, and keeping France for French people. You know, it's barely a dog whistle. It's pretty much a regular whistle. And so I think it's one of the reasons that the French can be so looking down their noses at the Americans is because of the similarities, that they're both these very, in many ways, self-centered civilizations, cultures with a very dark history of racism and colonialism that they do not want to deal with very much. And it's, I think, embarrasses the French about the similarities that they have with the Americans. So it's not easy to look back. We were never fleeing the U.S. Or anything like that. We weren't trying to leave because of Trump or COVID. We just wanted to get the kids here to learn their mother's tongue and to be close to my wife's parents.
Yeah,
that was the only reason. But now with the Roe versus Wade thing, it's the first time in my life where I am not as interested in coming back to the U.S. And, you know, I always thought, oh, I'll be back to New York. That's where I'm going to go after the kids are raised. But for the first time, it's been so difficult to watch the U.S. And even as it feels very, very inevitable, I think the more I study the history of fascism and the dark parts of the world, it's that, yes, the leaders are there taking advantage of it, but they're taking advantage of something that's already there. That groundswell of populist support, it's popular for a reason, usually economic reasons, racist reasons, whatever. But the leaders are just tapping into something that's there amongst the people. And as Orwell said, I think that's just this time in history, this century, a long, slow slide into totalitarianism. And it's almost like Asimov's Foundation books, where if you're really good at history, like someone like Orwell or Toynbee, and you're taking a long enough lens view on the world, this is kind of the end of this era of these nation states, civilizations, as they crash into each other, and it's just going to get uglier and uglier. And if I had any guesses, I'd guess that we're right around 1912 right now, and that World War One, with a new set of ways of fighting that are completely different to what we ever thought before, is probably not too far away, and we'll fall into it much, much quicker than we imagined we would. So it's not happy news, but it is how I've always seen it for the last 10 years or so.
Well, on the topic of war, you are a lot closer to the fighting than we are here in the U.S. What do you make of the whole Russia invading Ukraine thing and the U.S. gleefully engaging in a new proxy war?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. It's not funny. It's sad to see the repetition of exactly what the U.S. did in Afghanistan, because of Kissinger, when the Russians were in Afghanistan, the U.S. provided just enough aid to keep them engaged. And they knew all they ever needed to do was give them the type of weapons that could take down the helicopters. And the U.S. had them, and they simply did not give them to the Mujahideen. So the war would drag out for a very long time and sap the Russian nation. And it did. And that's exactly what it worked. I don't think that was the nefarious plan here. I think the crazy part about Ukraine is that this could be coming down to one guy's medication. Putin has been a genius, an evil genius. I mean, I think he set those car bombs that got him elected. If I had to guess, that's what all the evidence points to, which is a hell of a way to get elected. But he has been very smart in how he's clamped down and expanded bit by bit. And all of a sudden he makes this gamble in Ukraine, which is, turns out to be incredibly bad. And it almost seems like Hitler when he turned and he attacked Russia. And Hitler did that probably because of all the speed that he was taking. And there's all these rumors swirling around that Putin's in ill health, maybe Parkinson's, maybe something like that. And Parkinson's
I heard cancer.
Cancer could be it. The drugs for cancer wouldn't quite explain my thesis as much, but you know, you never know. But if it was Parkinson's, you're taking dopamine, and dopamine, you know, that's addiction. That's what people, you know, that's addictive tendencies, and people get really amped up if their levels of dopamine are too high. And it could be that whatever medication he's taking is making him act very erratically. And instead of, it could even be just SSRIs, which are linked to suicide and aggressive behavior. And for all of these young American men who go on shooting sprees, it's what links them is their SSRIs. It could be that it's some kind of medication that has changed Putin's mindset to not being nearly as sharp as he once was, and doing this incredibly aggressive and turns out incredibly stupid thing that's gonna ruin, it looks like, everything that he's been spending his life trying to do. Yeah, it could just be that one man's drugs is causing all of this pain, which is a crazy thing.
It's possible. Russia has been invaded from Europe many, many times, though. So they have what I would consider to be a well-deserved paranoia about that. And the borders of Russia are not particularly defensible, whereas the borders of the old Soviet Union were based more on terrain, you know, mountain ranges and rivers and things, and they were much more defensible. So, you know, drugs aside and psychological breakdown aside, as long as you are a Russian leader who takes the possibility that your country will be invaded from Western Europe seriously, and, you know, history says they do have to take that seriously, that, you know, it makes sense. You're going to expand your borders, you know, to something more defensible. Mm-hmm. But Russia is also in the midst of a demographic decline. You know, they forgot how to make babies. And so they don't have enough young people to serve in the military to support an expansionist program like that. So, yeah, I mean, it's just with utter glee that the Pentagon has, you know, seized upon this situation. It's like, Yes, let us send billions and billions of dollars in aid to Ukraine so that the Ukrainians can fight to the bitter end and, you know, drain Russia of the last of its vital, you know, personnel and energy and focus.
Yeah.
You know, and a phrase you'll hear repeatedly is, the U.S. is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian.
Yeah, it's dark. It's so dark. It's hard to watch. It's really hard to watch for it to be so close.
What's it like there on the continent? Because I know Germany has just finally, after, you know, president after president, U.S. president after U.S. president has said to the Germans, look, you have a very strong economy. You can pay for more of your own defense. You should do that. And the Germans have been like, yeah, we know you're not leaving, so why should we? And now Germany has said, yes, okay, it is time to step it up, you know, and remilitarize. That can't be something that the rest of Europe just is blasé about.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't say no. I know that Macron is stepping up and trying to expand the EU and to get more of those nations, not into EU membership, but into defensive categories, making like a European NATO kind of alliance. I don't know. A lot of stuff's above my pay grade. You know, I read about it, but I don't know where it's going to go.
Well, France has always been a military powerhouse and has been largely independent of the rest of Europe militarily. They even left NATO for quite some time. So yeah, France doesn't need to remilitarize. They never demilitarized, but Germany did in a big way. And, you know, much to their advantage, they got to spend that money developing their own economy, you know, and they knew that with NATO in place, the U.S. was not going to leave, that the U.S. would, you know, would certainly defend Germany against Soviet or later Russian incursion. And, you know, now the anxiety is, well, Germany has put itself in a very precarious position in that it is utterly dependent on hydrocarbon energy from Russia. And it would be very difficult for the United States to supply Germany with the natural gas that it now gets from Russia. But even so, Germany has pledged to, you know, to get off of Russian energy, which is a tall task. I mean, it's a tall order.
Yeah.
Things are in motion. Things are big things are happening right now in Europe, in the world. I mean, all over. And these are developments that are really hard to make sense of in real time. They come into focus in the rearview mirror.
Yeah. But I reckon the reckoning is approaching.
Well, I'll tell you one more thing on that topic. It's not European focused, but I have a long distance girlfriend in the Philippines and I talk to her daily, and the Filipinos just went to the polls. You know, they just had a presidential election. Oh, you heard about that?
Yeah. That
did not cross my screens here at all. None of the news shows I watched have commented on it. I went to Al Jazeera to look for a story, and it's buried way down, you know, below all the other stories. But remember Ferdinand Marcos? He had to flee the Philippines in 1986. He came to the U.S. His wife, Imelda, famously had, you know, an enormous shoe collection. And they had stolen billions of dollars from the Philippine people. His son just got elected as the president in a landslide. And he was running. His running mate is the daughter of Duterte, you know, the outgoing president, who is very much like the Philippine Trump. You know, he talks like a common person. He appeals. He brags about, you know, the murders that he committed as a police officer. You know, he's very thuggish, but the Filipino people love him. And they just, you know, they just ushered his daughter and Ferdinand Marcos' son into their version of the White House with, to call it a landslide would be to understate the matter.
Yeah. Populism is popular.
It's well, a right ground populism well. In this instance.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, well. It's scary. And Duterte, I mean, in my corner of the world, what he's famous for is his extreme crackdown on anyone using drugs. I mean, it was a horror show of human rights, what he did against drug users in his country. And you know, that stuff just isn't changing very fast. All the drug war stuff. Yeah, cannabis is getting a little bit more legal here and there, but the drug war rolls on, ruining lives everywhere. And the racism of it is only increasing and getting worse, and America has more people in jails than anyone else over this. Yeah, it's tough stuff to watch. But you have to. I mean, it's our jobs to watch it and pay attention and to try to make sense of it. But for me, I write about it. But, you know, being a writer, it just, you know, it's, yes, you know, you take, oh, revolutions were often started by writers. Oh, it matters, you know, and you say these things to people like, oh, it's good that you're getting information out there. You know, someone has to be doing that. It's like, yeah, I know they're supposed to be writers. But boy, it feels like such a paltry offering when the world is in such a state to just be writing about it from, you know, back here, not being someone on the front lines doing much, just studying the history of this and kind of being like, oh yeah, this all makes sense. This is kind of how it always goes.
Well, you know, I'll pump you up a little bit on that score. Action taken in the absence of historical context, action taken in the absence of careful, calm observation and reflection is unlikely to be helpful action. It is more likely to exacerbate the problems that sparked it.
That's true. That's true. So I'll counter with maybe my favorite quote from Huxley, which is, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. But those who do know history are doomed to watch other people repeat it.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Well, Lex, this has been a lot of fun. The one thing I would ask you to repeat from the first part of our conversation is give folks a description of your podcast, where they can find it, and what they would expect or should expect to find if they check it out.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and so I have my podcast. It's at lexpelger.com, P-E-L-G-E-R. And the Lex Files, I focus on drugs. I also focus on health, both mental and physical. And I'm starting to have a lot more guests about the supernormal or paranormal or supernatural, which I'm approaching very much as a scientist because there is a lot of science on things like telepathy, ESP, even UFOs. Though the world is stranger than we know about in our books. And I also write graphic novels about the cannabis and the history of it, the history of the war on drugs and the endocannabinoid system based on Moby Dick. You can see three of the books at lexpelger.com. And I actually started something new recently. I started a business for myself called White Whale Creations, where I do content for cannabis and psychedelic companies, but I also do counseling sessions one-on-one with people who are looking to use cannabis, CBD, PEA, any of the endocannabinoid type things out there for their serious conditions. And so it's just $50. But I am very good at helping to walk people, especially older people, where I think this is such an amazing medicine for everything that involves aging. Aging is such a complex thing, but the cannabinoids are so often helpful. And yes, they have all the science to like back up. Yes, we should give this a try, but that's not what people need. People need walk through what to try, how long to try it, what times of day. And that's what I really want to go through with people. And that's what I've been doing with the cannabis thing since the very beginning, ever since I got into this because of my grandmother's Parkinson's. And so if that appeals to anyone, or you know anyone who might be interested in using cannabis but is a little bit nervous about it, I'm here to help them. And you can find that at White Whale Creations. And even if it's just interest you, you can go there and I have a bunch of FAQs for people walking them through how to use CBD and THC and PEA for sleep and pain, neurodegenerative disorders, autoimmune disorders. And so just check out the FAQs. I think it'd be helpful for anyone who's not scared of these drugs. You can go out and try them yourself. So that's at White Whale Creations. And then my creative work is at lexpelger.com. Oh, and I have a new newsletter. It's called Cannabinoids and the People. You can sign up at whitewhalecreations.com, but it's a weekly newsletter. I go through every Google Scholar hit for cannabinoids that comes up each week. So usually it's like 50 different science papers, as well as, you know, what I feel like covering in psychedelics and the war on drugs and the law and business. But the one thing I do is I cover every piece of cannabis science that comes out every week, along with my little funny commentary and my living glossary about how each of those cannabinoids is like a whale, and how each of the cannabinoids from the hemp plant is like an elephant, and how all of it works together. So if you like cannabinoid science, Cannabinoids and the People is my new newsletter.
Right on. Well, Lex, let's not wait so long to talk again.
That sounds great. This has been a lot of fun, Camo. It's great to see you.
Alrighty, that was Lex Pelger. I still have not listened to an episode of his podcast, but I'm definitely going to in the coming days. But for right now, I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that podcasting just doesn't seem to generate much response, at least, you know, the way I do it. Posting, I have my own RSS feed. It's comments, if people are going to leave them, are on the C Realm podcast website. and they just don't. They just don't leave comments. And it is the feedback, you know, that is my immediate reward for putting up a podcast. That's my reinforcement, basically. And podcasting, the way I do it, and again, you know, I've been doing this for going on 20 years now. I mean, it hasn't been 20 years, but I'm well past the decade and a half mark. That's the next odometer moment that I'm closing in on. And, you know, I'm still, like, listen to this.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast. C stands for consciousness.
That's Black Beauty, you know, formerly of BB's Bungalow. Somebody who I met through the Dope Fiend podcast. And I've never met her. She lives in Melbourne, Australia. Olga has met her, actually, in Melbourne. But she recorded a batch of bumpers for me back in, I don't know, like 2007, I guess. She recorded a second batch maybe a year or so later and sent them along. But, you know, these are audio files that I have been pulling out of a folder and dropping into these podcasts for over a decade. So, you know, the system that I established for creating these podcasts and the workflow is not very streamlined. I remember I was talking to Doug Lane, I don't know, a couple of years ago now, and he told me that, you know, he used to slave over the editing of his podcasts. And you could tell his early podcasts, you know, there's audio collages and his stuff was scripted out and, you know, very carefully edited, meticulously edited. And now he's just recording conversations with people and throwing them up, you know, on his feeds pretty much unedited. And I'm not doing that. So, you know, for me, making a podcast takes a long time. Making a YouTube video takes very little time. I don't prepare much. I don't do much editing because what editing I do, I'm doing on the phone. I can't see an audio waveform. I just don't have the control to do the sort of tight editing that I do on a podcast. So it's a very, and you know, I don't prepare. I don't script it out. I rarely even have bullet points prepared in advance. Sometimes I don't even know what topic I'll be talking about. It's just, you know, the urge comes upon me, set up the camera and start jabbering. And when I say camera, it's my cell phone. You know, it's my smartphone. I've got a microphone, like lapel mic attached, paired with it. And the mic is physically attached to my body. So the sound is decent, but the preparation is certainly lacking and the post-production also lacking. You know, maybe I'll throw up some images to illustrate the points I'm talking about, but really there's not a whole lot to them, but they generate, given the effort that I put into them, they generate quite a bit of feedback. But then reading and responding to that feedback doesn't really fit the vibe of my video production method. That's more of a podcast thing. So what I'm going to do to close out the hour here, and we're just past the halfway point in the podcast. I'm not going to play audio from one of my YouTube videos because I know some of you, not all of you, but some of you tune into those on YouTube. So I'm not going to, you know, for that portion of the audience, I'm not going to subject you to a repeat of something you've already heard. I'll just briefly summarize, you know, the topic of a video and then read some responses because people prepare, you know, they spend more time responding to the video, I think, than I spent actually making the darn thing, which I appreciate. You know, I really appreciate a well-crafted response, something that has clearly been proofread and edited before somebody hit reply. I value that. And so if you're the sort of person who provides that type of feedback, thank you very much. Please continue. So a video that I did recently, and this is hilarious, you know, it's only got 200 views, but it has 47 comments, which in the world of, you know, the parasocial, where somebody is putting out stuff to the world, if you don't want to get that many comments for so small an audience, that's called being ratioed. And it is, you know, algorithmically speaking, it is a sign that people disapprove of your content, which is clearly not the case in this instance. So the topic is student debt forgiveness. And, you know, there are a lot of people who feel betrayed, both students and their parents. It has just been a fact of life in previous decades that if you go to college, you will make more money than you would have if you didn't go to college. It hasn't been universally true. You know, there've always been people who go to school, get trained for something and then end up not working in that field. And some people have always ended up doing work that didn't require any post-secondary education and, you know, getting paid accordingly. But now that's much more likely to happen than it was in the past. And more importantly, a college education is much more expensive than it was in the past. So the topic of student debt relief was current a couple weeks back. You know, one of the talking points from the White House was President Biden was considering through executive action, you know, an executive order, wiping out the debts, $10,000 worth of student debt, either from everybody or from everybody who's making less than a certain amount of money. Now, that went by the wayside without any action. Really, it was just a talking point to keep people from looking at something else for a minute. And I didn't mention it on a podcast at the time because I do not want these podcasts to be caught up in the news cycle. You know, the things that I talk about here are things which are of interest to me and I imagine interest to you, and they are not specifically tied to the agenda setting mechanism of the government and the mainstream corporate media, and even the sort of, you know, alternative media that I'd like to take in, like Rising from the Hill and now Breaking Points with Crystal Ball and Sagar and Jetty. I mean, these shows are offering counter narratives to the mainstream narrative, but the topics that they bring up and the timing of them and the duration for which they are current and relevant is determined by the mainstream mind control agenda and mechanisms. And, you know, when I say mind control, I'm not talking Manchurian candidate, do you see the Red Queen, now go and kill the president sort of thing. Just, you know, if the president and if Fox News and MSNBC are all talking about the same thing, well, then that's what's going to occupy everybody's attention on Twitter. And, you know, they have the power just because of our media arrangements and our social media arrangements to command people to think about a certain topic at a certain time, and they do. We do. So with my podcasting efforts, I'd like to stay just somewhat removed from that whole cycle, that whole apparatus and structure. So, you know, now the talking points are something else. They've moved on from student debt. So now I'll talk a bit about student debt. But I did talk about it when it was current on a video, and I haven't even gone back and rewatched the video. I'm just sort of using people's comments on it to refresh my memory of what I said. But one of the points I made was that, you know, student debt is such a problem now, largely because college is so much more expensive than it used to be. And people go to college not because they want to learn and improve themselves for the most part, which some commenters definitely agreed with. They go because they understand that that's part of the life path that is expected of a middle-class person who intends to stay middle-class and not drop down into the class of the working poor. So even if they were not particularly strong students in high school, you know, they didn't have helicopter parents, they didn't have like ACT prep courses and things like that, they didn't take college prep high school courses, you know, they're not in a STEM field. They're not particularly good at math or science. You know, they're not going to be coders of any sort. They're not going to be engineers, but they're still going to go to school. They're going to get that 4-year, just general liberal arts education. And then with that, go out into the workforce and try to find a job that pays enough that's going to allow them to not only support themselves, start a family, but also, you know, eventually pay off that debt. And in the short term, if not pay it off, at least just stay current, you know, on the maintenance of that debt to maintain your credit rating. But college is so much more expensive now because the government, the federal government, guarantees, or at least this was the case. I'll read a comment from somebody who says that maybe this isn't so much the case anymore, but private lenders give students that money and they don't do much underwriting. They don't do much research into the viability of the loan because the government backstops it. If the student defaults, the government is going to step in and make the lender whole. But because of amendments to bankruptcy protection laws orchestrated by Joe Biden, you know, Senator Joe Biden at the time, this is before even he was vice president, it is impossible to discharge student debt in bankruptcy. You know, many other types of debt can be discharged if you file for bankruptcy, but not your student loans. So that is a debt that it presents no risk whatsoever to the lender, but it presents enormous risk to the borrower. It can hang over you for your entire working career. And if it's still not paid off by the time you've retired, your Social Security payments will be garnished in order to pay back that debt. And somebody in that instance is likely to have never even touched the principal. They're just working away to pay the accrued interest. And they'll pay on it until they die, you know, via deductions from their Social Security payments. But because the lenders are free with the money, because they're taking no risks, the schools themselves can continue to elevate the cost of the education. And they have to raise their prices because they have been adding more and more administrative staff to the point where administrative staff sometimes outnumbers teaching staff, you know, outnumbers the faculty. And it is this administrative staff which is largely responsible for driving the diversity, equity, and inclusion mandates, you know, which make college this, which have transformed college into this thing which either instills you with some very strange ideas or, you know, you have to devote a lot of time and attention to resisting that indoctrination and sometimes push back against it so hard that, you know, you become reciprocally, maybe this isn't the word, this is how I remembered it, reciprocally radicalized. You radicalize in the opposite direction from that you're being pushed in by college administrators and by proxy, college professors and adjunct professors and, you know, teaching assistants and graduate instructors. And these administrative roles are very highly paid. You know, these are solid upper middle class jobs, whereas, ironically, much more and more of the teaching is being done by adjunct professors who get paid very little, who don't have any sort of job security, and who burn out pretty quickly. And as has always been the case, you know, a lot of the teaching is done by graduate students who, like when I was a graduate student, I worked basically for a tuition waiver and a small stipend. So in the video, I proposed, and I didn't come up with this. I forget who I read it from, but, you know, having forgotten and having said it to a bunch of people, it's now mine. One thing that would improve the situation, I think, but, you know, it's kind of hard to predict the output of a complex adaptive system. You know, you just have to try something. And if the results are counterintuitive and non-productive, then you stop doing that. You try something else. But one thing that could help to fix this situation would be to stop guaranteeing that the lenders will be made whole if the student defaults, so that the banks have to treat the application, you know, a student loan application like any other application, like an application for a small business. You know, they would have to do some research and look at the students, you know, their scholastic performance in high school, look at their grades, basically do all the things that college administrators do to look at the student to determine whether or not this student, given their track record and given the type of degree that they're planning to work on in college, whether or not their job prospects post-college are going to be suitable for paying back the loan. And if somebody who was, you know, like a B-minus student in high school, who's not going to be pursuing a STEM degree, is just going to college to get that pro forma liberal arts four-year, you know, certificate, which basically says that they're middle class and they should get a middle class job. Well, the banks understand that certificate doesn't get you a middle class living anymore, and it doesn't provide you with enough income that you will realistically be able to even service, much less pay back the loan. At that point, the bank should say no. This is not a loan that is likely to be paid back. We're not going to make this loan. That would dramatically reduce the amount of money flowing into the coffers of universities, and the universities would then have to cut costs. Thus, using market incentives to bring the cost of an education in line with its current value. Because this whole dynamic of the government guaranteeing that the lender will be made whole, thus allowing the universities to continuously jack up their prices to ridiculous degrees, is a racket. It is a racket, and the people holding the bag are the students and the taxpayers. But here's another consideration. I mean, yes, it would be of great benefit to people who are struggling in a workplace where they're not making enough to pay back or even service that debt. It would be a great relief to them to have some of that debt burden lifted from them. But at whose expense? It's not going to be at the expense of the lender. If the president signs an executive order and says, everybody's, you know, student debt load has been lifted by $10,000, that money is not being taken from the lenders. You know, it is not the banks that are going to be left holding the bag for that. It's going to be the taxpayers, most of whom didn't go to college, most of whom will not directly benefit from this measure. So it is definitely a class-based benefit. It is a benefit given to people who grew up with middle-class expectations and aspirations, and it will be funded by everybody, most of the people funding that will not be in that class. Although you could say that most of the money, you know, raised via taxes to bail out the failing middle class will come from the ultra wealthy, because they are the ones who, while they do pay the lowest tax rates, pay the most actual tax. But anyway, it is a class-based benefit, and it's really, you know, it is not fair to people who just went to work, who entered the workforce immediately out of high school, many of whom are struggling. You know, they're in the same desperate state as people who took 4 or 5 years to get a useless, vocationally useless liberal arts degree. You know, a lot of people who didn't go to college are still struggling because it's a tough job market right now. It's a tough economy. It's an economy that has basically outsourced the need for a lot of the labor that produced the strong middle class of the post-World War II, you know, mid-20th century decades. All right, so I've spent way too long setting up the topic. In fact, I probably could have just played you the video in the time that I've spent summarizing it. But now let's get on to some of the comments, because the comments from this video were just excellent. So Pleopod, who I don't know Pleopod's real name, and I don't know if he or she, I'm guessing he, most of my listeners are he's, is a CROM Vault subscriber, but Pleopod regularly comments on my my YouTube videos, and I'm assuming he writes, "This is very much top of my mind for me at the moment, as my son is in his final year at school. He has dyslexia and has worked very hard to get himself into the position where if he passes this year, university will be an option. However, I have grave concerns about him borrowing money to get a degree, especially as he has no real idea what he wants to study. I have persuaded him to take a year out so we can really work out if running up a big debt for a university education is something he wants to do. The contrast to my experience of university is stark. I paid no fees, and my parents were able to pay my living expenses. However, if your parents could not afford to, then the state would provide. I lived away from home, made great friends, met my wife, studied and partied hard, and got a job right at the end of it. It now seems like some kind of utopian fantasy compared to the racket that the sector has become." And I responded, "Your college experience does sound like a utopian scenario. I left school with a bit more than $30,000 in debt. The same state school that I attended now costs over $10,000 per semester. If a student got their bachelor's degree in 8 semesters flat, which means studying diligently and not dropping courses in order to have a second go at them later, that would be $80,000 in student debt to repay. And that could easily balloon to $100,000 if the normal setbacks occur. So while I didn't have the zero-fee college education that you did, someone looking to replicate my educational experience would be paying many times what I paid. My two sons are both of college age, so this is a pressing issue for me as well." To which Pleopod responded, "I went to university in the UK before the Blair Labour government implemented student loans. I also had a year gap between school and starting my degree. Without doing this, I would have flunked out for sure." And Thomas chimed in this subthread and said, "I would not pursue a degree unless it were a professional degree in a field that is in demand. I know someone that just went to a computer coding crash course that cost them a fraction of what college would have cost, and well-paying work looks promising. I think I mentioned in the video that I was kind of hoping my youngest son, who is graduating from high school this month, would join the Coast Guard, because he lives in Maryland, right on the Chesapeake Bay. There is lots of shipping that goes on there, and somebody with, you know, a young person with experience relevant to water transport, there are many job opportunities there. And also, and this is somewhat cynical, if he's in the Coast Guard, he can't be drafted into the Army or the Marines or, you know, some other service which might well get him killed. So Thomas continues, the Coast Guard is always an option to get the GI Bill and hopefully be in one piece at the end. It also gives you time to grow up and hopefully lead you to choose a more practical field of study. The sense of having earned it may also spill over into his studies. There is also the added benefit of lifetime VA hospital treatment. If you want to learn a trade, I would suggest applying to a trade union that is a licensed field like plumbing, HVAC, or electric. Training will be free, but you need to have thick skin. If you live in a pro-union state or city, I would suggest taking civil service exams. Some of these jobs will have a pension and may pay for part-time training and/or college, although many of these jobs are now declining in pay and benefits. And Thomas, just responding to the main video, not the thread started by Pleopod, writes, debt forgiveness would increase the inflation problem, which disproportionately affects working and poor people that have no extra income, and most of whom did not go to college, and caused the problem in the first place. So I'm going to pause here. There's more to his comment, but I've really struggled with, you know, the claim that debt forgiveness would increase the inflation problem. From my perspective, either paying off a debt or defaulting on a debt, either way, basically removes money from the money supply. You know, money that the banks had expected would be coming their way won't be. So I'm not saying that Thomas is wrong about debt forgiveness increasing the inflation problem. I just don't see how that mechanism would work. But Thomas continues, I agree with your bankruptcy idea. Oh, I think I mentioned in the video that student debt should be dischargeable in bankruptcy like any other debt. So Thomas says, I agree with your bankruptcy idea and bank due diligence when it comes to lending and not guaranteeing loans. Most colleges need to go away as they act as a barrier to entry for jobs that should not otherwise require a college degree. And like you said, they have become racketeers. I have worked in the building trades for over 20 years and went to trade school, but also have a liberal arts degree. Cringe. And Thomas put cringe in there. That's not me adding the cringe editorially. For the degree, I bought into the same story about gaining better employment and did notice the stigma that comes with working with your hands. Financially and career-wise, what a waste of time and money. I would like to see high school become trade and career-focused rather than teaching to the SATs and standardized tests. And this is me editorializing. Now many of the top schools, because, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, because black students don't perform as well on standardized tests, have eliminated standardized testing from their, you know, their admissions requirement or their admissions evaluation process. Thomas continues, one note about the trades, mass immigration lowers wages as a function of supply and demand. The trades will continue to decline in pay and benefits so long as mass immigration is the policy in the U.S. The labor market is subject to the laws of supply and demand. This means lower pay and declining rates of unionization, which serves to dissuade many people from the industry now. As a tradesman, it is crucial to have a retirement plan and benefits due to injuries and abuse to your body. It is not a job you can do forever, and if you do not have a valid retirement strategy, you will be tossed into the trash heap like some broken machine. This is something that Paul in Texas has mentioned repeatedly. You know, he's got a college education, but a lot of the people that he grew up with went directly to work, and, you know, they have they hold prejudicial attitudes against him because he went to college, calling him college boy and such, and insisting that if you're not working with your hands, you're not really working. But, says Paul, and I completely agree because I've done a fair amount of manual labor myself over the course of my life, you can't do hard physical labor until the retirement age at 65, which is why so many people, you know, who don't have college educations and who were doing physically demanding work in their youth end up, you know, stopping work in their mid-40s and spending the time between, you know, when they stop working and the beginning of the official retirement age on disability. Dan writes, I have decades of experience in tertiary education, and I have met a meager handful of students who could identify themselves as people who want to, quote, learn, who want to increase their knowledge, their sophistication, their ability to articulate complex thoughts in simple or at least understandable language, close quote. And he's quoting me there. That's something I said in the video. Dan continues, get a high school diploma and then get out of the house. go to an ashram in India, hike the Pacific Coast Trail, pick grapes in California, do anything other than go to university for 5 years. Then, if there is something you find you really need and it can only be acquired at a college, then do that. Otherwise, spend your 20s acquiring other skills that will serve you in the future. That is my advice to any 18-year-old today. And I responded to Dan saying, my university experience was very valuable to me, but mostly in terms of the self-cultivation I described. I think that the danger of succumbing to the Dunning-Kruger effect is very high when one's education is entirely self-directed. Instructors who prompt us to read and write on texts and subjects that we're not already inclined to pursue is of great benefit to the developing mind, in my opinion. That said, for a young person today to replicate my university experience would cost several times what I paid back in the 90s. Starting one's working life with an enormous debt burden will likely prove both a financial and psychological hindrance that will dog that person for life. To which Dan says, this is my third try in this. I don't think a university education today should be considered in isolation. The cost of a good liberal arts degree for a student right out of high school is a bad investment, especially if the goal is utilitarian. Though mine has been valuable to me, I do not encourage my children to single-mindedly pursue any college degree. I encourage them to pursue what they are good at. There is no way an 18-year-old can make decisions about what they want to be when they grow up, so try various things in their youth, slowly whittling away at the options. For $100,000 and years of indebtedness, a university degree had better explode the students' brains. That requires an informed learner and a superior program. I don't see too many exploding brains. I mostly see indifference. Students who have been in the world for a few years before choosing to come to college are a completely different species. And I responded to Dan, before I transferred to the University of Missouri, I got an associate's degree from Penn Valley Community College. I'm glad I did. Had I gone straight to the university setting and lived in a dorm with a bunch of other 18-year-olds, I likely would have partied like there was no tomorrow and flunked out, as my father did when he went to university at the age of 18. A lot of the students at Penn Valley were working adults. Some were even senior citizens. It was certainly a much more diverse and mature egregore than what I found when I did eventually end up transferring to the university setting and living in a dorm with a bunch of 18-year-olds. One thing I did notice about the community college experience was that I took great interest in philosophy courses, and I would devote the time and effort required to give the assigned text close and sometimes repeated reading before classroom discussions. I worked part-time, but my bartending job left me plenty of time for study and recreation. Some students who were working full-time and were just there for the credentials resented me for actually being interested in the topic and doing more than the bare minimum to pass the class and get the credit, which is what they were trying to do. Those students were not in the majority, but the self-righteousness that some of them expressed about working full-time has stuck with me for 30 years. Someone posting under the title Bureau of Labor Education writes, I'm writing from my work account, and I work at a university. Not unsurprisingly, I support higher education and actually think we need more of it. I also think that the proposed debt cancellation is unlikely to come to fruition, and even if it did, it would be a drop in the bucket. Practically speaking, higher ed, the way it is constituted now, with debt built in and the U.S. government backstopping losses, is a subsidized racket. So many things are these days, and probably always were. I paid off 5+ years of grad school debt myself, over $100,000, in one fell swoop because I, like KMO, was lucky. I sold a house at the top of the biggest housing bubble in U.S. history. My education assisted me by giving me the tools to know that we had reached the top of the market when others were still buying. I felt a bit nauseous when I sold the house, knowing the new owner was getting shafted, but such is the nature of capitalism. To my credit, I actually told her that she should consider the state of the housing market and the median income of homeowners in the neighborhood, and a few other telltale signs. She stared at me like I was crazy and borrowed a lot of money and closed right on time, making me debt-free. I currently live in an area where very low sub-high school education achievement is common. I also spent most of my life as a union staffer representing workers at various levels of educational attainment. My experience tells me educated people live better lives, not just financially, but in almost every conceivable way. Societies need to find a way to educate their citizens throughout their life, whether they are intent on work, in academia, or doing industrial pipe fitting. Human society is becoming too complex and the consequences of human actions too dangerous to allow any sector of society to remain ignorant. A vast complex of interlocking mythologies. For example, Adam and Eve suggest there is something beneficial about the simple and ignorant. My experience, at least, suggests otherwise. They are not better in any way and more likely to act out in violence and be prey to reactionary movements and leaders. We need more, not less, education at every level, including adults and academics, but society as a whole needs to shoulder this cost. Perhaps, if we weren't subsidizing the weapons industry and attempting to reinvigorate our collapsing empire abroad, we might afford more in this regard. But education, like healthcare, will not be free or cheap in any society, and my suggestion is that we just accept that and pay for them up front. Our lives would be immeasurably better for it. So I think I agree in spirit with much of what the Bureau of Labor Education has posted here. But I think if we removed people, I think it was Socrates who said that compulsory physical exercise does no harm to the body, but compulsory learning, you know, compulsory academic study does. I think for people who are exposed to some liberal arts education and really thrive on it and want more, they should have access to more, and it shouldn't come, you know, it shouldn't be a recipe for lifelong indebtedness and poverty. But as a previous commenter mentioned, you know, if you go to universities and you look around at all the people who are reading great literature and, you know, being exposed to the most valuable ideas that have come down through, you know, our culture for thousands of years, most of them are disinterested. They're doing the least bit necessary in order to get a passing grade so that they can get the accreditation, so that they can go into the job market with that accreditation. They don't really care. Their minds are not exploding. Their brains are not exploding because of their exposure to the canon of Western thought, or, you know, I would say even less so because they are being exposed to the new canon of, which rejects the classics of Western thought. So much of the very, very educational experience that these, you know, kids, I struggle with that, but to me they are kids, even though they're legal adults. Most of this very expensive education is wasted on them. But I think most of the people who listen to the C-Realm podcast or subscribe to The Vault or comment on my videos are in the minority, in that they really were passionate learners in school, and they want everybody to have access to that, you know, that experience and that enrichment. And I want everybody to have access to it, but if they find that they don't, you know, if it's not for them, if they don't respond to it the way I did, the way Bureau of Labor Statistics did, then we shouldn't really incentivize them to keep at it at great cost. Of course, I agree that the unexamined life is not as rewarding as the examined life, but I won't go so far as to say that it's not worth living. Vagabond Caleb posted the following, and I don't know how old Vagabond Caleb is, you know, or when he or she went to school, but Vagabond Caleb writes, "I was forced to pay $15 per day for two meals a day. I didn't even get breakfast, and for the first 3 years of college, you are forced to both live in the dorms and have a meal plan at my college. If that isn't coercive, I don't know what is. I could have saved like $10,000 or more just from living off campus and buying my own food. Colleges need to be forced through some sort of selection mechanism, because most are mostly Ponzi schemes. But you have all this debt. You have all this debt, but you can't get rid of it without further incentivizing shitty parasite schools." To which I responded, "The system by which the federal government removes all risk from the lenders and thus enables college tuition to balloon to obscene levels has to end before we can realistically talk about debt forgiveness. Wiping out debt without first reforming a perverse racket will create an enormous moral hazard that will incentivize continued parasitic behavior." To which Thomas writes, "One reason for not forgiving college loans would be to cause pain. Sadly, pain is often the primary catalyst for change. The change we need to see is the end of the academic business model and our primary approach to education. To achieve this, people need to be thoroughly disillusioned with the old model, so that it is not worth saving and becomes reviled. Otherwise, it will never go away or change. The new retro model should be apprenticeship as the primary way of education and accreditation. An apprenticeship combines relevant on-the-job paid work experience with no or low-cost night classes or day classes. There is no reason this cannot be applied to much of the medical field, nurses, techs, etc., plus the legal field and teaching. And it traditionally was. Starting at the bottom and working your way up also teaches a person the entire business, which can be highly beneficial to future managers. It is also beneficial to the apprentice because you get to earn while you learn. Brian writes, for all the reasons you state, along with the woke academia phenomenon, I plan to send my kids to a European university. Greg writes, my niece is starting college next year. I heard it's $60,000 and that's a state school. I just don't see how this is practical or even possible. Hopefully she picks an employable major, but if I were starting now, I would rack up as many hours as possible in a community college and then finish off at the most prestigious university I could justify paying for. The fact that so many people are signing off on that debt without at least doing some calculation on what they are getting into says something about the collective intelligence of our culture. To which I responded, for young people, I think the numbers concerning the debt burden they'll be taking on are an abstraction. From their perspective, it's either enter a bleak and unforgiving job market immediately or stay in school for as long again as they spent in high school. Faced with that choice, I can understand why so many young people choose to kick the can down the road, even if the financial cost is staggering. Urban Paradise responded, if your niece became a New York resident for a year, they could take advantage of our SUNY school system, our SUNY school program. SUNY is State University of New York. They are well-regarded and a lot cheaper. Then again, living in the state of New York comes with a whole new set of issues. I won't continue on that thread because I basically talk about my time in New York and benefiting from being low income in the state of New York, which has very generous welfare programs. Parker writes, hello, KMO. Occasionally those liberal arts degrees pay off. Well, mine certainly did. Anyway, Parker continues, I have listened to interviews of writers of shows I watched and who got English degrees. I have listened to writers of books. And some of them, while for sure not as well off as the TV writers, have also have liberal arts degrees. While the cost of resort-style campuses and having a live human give lectures rather than a recording does not make sense to me, I believe there is value in having people with liberal arts education. Maybe there are too many of them. I don't know. But would not want only STEM degrees to be given out. To which I responded, I value the liberal arts, but the costs cannot escalate infinitely. Sure, some people take their liberal arts degree out into the world and make a fortune. Some high school athletes go to college for free on an athletic scholarship and then become professional athletes and make millions of dollars in their 20s. It happens, but it's not a dependable life path that one can, in good conscience, prescribe to any young person who dreams of being a professional athlete. So here's a comment that I had in mind when I started to read these to you. So I'm glad I didn't give up before now. Runer Jeff writes, I have worked for a student loan guarantor since 2003. Originally, there were 50 guarantors for the FFEL program loans, bank-issued loans guaranteed by the GAs and reinsured by the Department of Education. Today, 16 guarantors, or GAs, remain, and over 70% of the remaining loans are on data system as either servicing or software as a service. The Illinois GA closed last week, and we loaded their remaining portfolio onto our system over the weekend. The GA system has been in wind down since 2010, as no bank-issued loans being guaranteed by GAs or the federal government, as all new guaranteed loans since June 2010 have been only made by the Department of Education. So I wrote to Jeff saying, I don't think I'm getting the full import of this statement. What does it mean for loans to be on data system as software as a service? To which Jeff replied, SAS versus client servicing is with SAS. They run their business while we provide basically the software. We also service six GAs in addition to the two that we are. The clients we handle claim processing, federal filing, and really run it for them. And I responded, is your larger point that banks are getting out of the student loan business? And Jeff didn't reply to that. So I was very interested in that comment because, you know, he's somebody on the inside with a privileged viewpoint. But I didn't understand his point. William writes, Maybe better to let the universities guarantee the loans. Then they'd actually focus more on providing capable students with marketable degrees. Personally, I like Germany's approach, i.e. state-funded third-level education, which doesn't appear to have bankrupted the country or negatively affected quality. And none of this university chauvinism either, as a good chunk of that is trade school, which is equally respected. To which I responded, I haven't studied the German system, but your description of it makes it sound far more sensible than the U.S. approach. That said, students come from around the world to study at U.S. universities. They clearly do something right. I wouldn't want to lose what works in the quest to shrug off the parasitic elements of the current system. To which William responded, true. But students also come from around the world to study at universities in countries like Germany, too. The biggest hurdle to studying in Germany is probably the language, since English is a far more widely spoken foreign language globally, so countries like the US and UK definitely have that going for them. Honestly, once you're in top-tier universities in any of these countries, quality of education will be fantastic. It might be a different story at postgraduate level, but then you'll be seeking out those universities leading in the specific area of research you wish to pursue. One, albeit perhaps minor thing to consider, is the typically lower drinking age outside of the U.S. Indeed, it's 16 in Germany for weaker alcohols, for example, beer, wine, and cider, still 18 for hard liquor. As a young European back in the day, it would have definitely rubbed me the wrong way going to the U.S. and suddenly having to relinquish my newly acquired adult rights for another 3 years. Yeah, I grew up in the 80s where I was in Missouri when I turned 18, and at the time, the drinking age in Missouri had just switched from 18 to 21, but I could go to other states like Wisconsin, where the drinking age was still 18, and drink. That was a very strange experience, you know, being an adult in one place and not in the other. Okay, we're getting fairly close to the end here, and kind of change topics, and I can't pursue this change of topic as far as it deserves to be pursued, but I'll give you a taste of it. Thomas writes, and this is a different Thomas. Thomas M. writes, the USA is in a state of collapse, that this is just one of the many predicaments that are contributing to the downfall. Not everyone can be saved by the trades. We are working hard to eliminate all labor. Robot waiters? ? To which I responded, we are a long way from having robots that can navigate the chaos of a construction site and install/repair plumbing or electrical wiring. But yes, not everyone can be a plumber any more than everyone can be a doctor or a software engineer. Thomas responded, do a search on construction robots, very advanced and will continue to improve. Also, the construction site can be modified to accommodate them. Yes, the existing housing stock needs to be maintained, but it's only a matter of time until it too is modified to allow robots on the scene. And I'm guessing that Thomas is not a longtime listener to the C-Rome podcast. He seems to assume that I'm not following the advancement of automation. Anyway, I responded, nowhere even close to being able to do the job of a human plumber. Thomas responded, the robot element is irrelevant because workers' livelihoods are being destroyed by mass immigration. Mass immigration hurts both trade unions and self-employed tradespeople. Technological improvements and prefabrication have deleted many jobs. Some large heavy machinery jobs do use GPS, like big agriculture, but there still has to be someone in the seat because computers don't see marshy ground and similar obstacles. Laser levels have replaced transits and water levels, which used to be a two-man job. CNC routers have dug into shop work, but have not eliminated tradespeople altogether. I agree with KMO that as of yet, there are no do-it-all construction robots that I have seen. And to anyone who is obsessed with China's miracle construction, I would look up tofu dregs. And First of Incelmatics posted, lots of trades coping in the comments, lol. By which he means, I think he means that, and other people have pointed this out, that yeah, plumbers and electricians and HVAC technicians don't go to college. They get their education, which is technical and specialized, but they get it via a different path, and they're making a lot more money than people who spend $100,000 to get a liberal arts degree on average. But we can't just say, let's convert education and direct everybody into the trades. There's not enough employment there to do that. That's like saying, learn to code. People who do some sort of coding for their work is about 9% of the workforce. You can't direct the other 91% of the workforce into that 9% of the job sector and expect everybody to get work. It's just not going to happen. The same is true with plumbing. You know, the same is true with electrical work. Yes, those are high-paid sectors in the workforce, given, you know, particularly given what they pay for their education. But that sector of the workforce can't absorb all the people who are being displaced by automation, advancing technology, and aggressive courting of low-wage immigrants and even high-wage immigrants. But part of the, you know, the woke professional managerial class belief system is that the only reason anybody would ever object to unrestricted mass immigration is racism, which is beyond not helpful. Okay, gadzooks, this portion of the podcast has taken much, much longer than I had anticipated, so I'm going to stop there. But of course, if this topic is of interest to you, and I know it is of interest to, you know, several of you, I would very much enjoy reading your responses to this discussion as I have relayed it. Post in the show notes to crealm.com or Patreon, you know, if that's how you get the podcast, or send me an email, kmo@c-realm.com. All right. I'm going to stop here. I will talk to you again soon. Thank you very much for subscribing, and stay well.